Tony, take a look at this. Whether we'll see how it turns out, but here's one thing I do appreciate is that for whatever reason, he had to make a change at the offensive coordinator, and he did it. He found he coming off of a pretty successful season with a, you know, fairly successful defense. He parted ways with a guy that many people around here, you know, were saying was a great defensive coordinator, and went and got the money and brought in Bob Shoup. And then with this, he's going a different direction with his strength and conditioning. So here's a guy that really has no history, or would be not in a position to have that kind of history. He's realizing he is in the big time, and it looks like he's not afraid. We've had other coaches that would just tell us we've won a lot of games around here just like this. I kind of appreciate that, to be honest with you.
Totally agree. Couldn't agree more.
I think he's made an upgrade with every hire, too, guys. Major hires he's made, I would state that we've upgraded. Now, I don't know if I think they've been reactive rather than proactive.
Yes.
And from this point on, they'll probably have to be proactive. I think he's done a good job with that. One last thing, and I'll get out of the way.
And Beano, I got to call something to you and Sean's attention before you do your one last thing.
Okay. Okay.
Tennessee had a 5-0 lead today in baseball. They were home free, going to win a series. Auburn's Nick Benatello has just knocked a solo home run over the right field fence. The Tigers now lead 6-5 over our Volunteers with two outs in the eighth inning.
That's surprising. Was that off of in the bullpen?
I would have no idea.
Yes, it was.
Well, that's just you know what? We're in a tough spot because He's got average to good starting pitching, and he really needs a complete game out of any of those, or it's just an absolute Russian roulette.
And, I mean, you still got Georgia and Missouri that are winnable series, but I'll tell you the truth, if you can't win a series against Auburn, I don't believe you're going to win one.
They're terrible.
Last player thing here, guys, and I'll get out of your way. When I wear a jersey to a Tennessee football game, I wear number 7. I don't think it's a stretch to say the two guys that wear that number are going to play a huge part in what kind of football season we have, and that's Preston Williams on the offensive side and Rashawn Galdon on the defensive side.
Special players.
I hope they're special players. We need them to be. We need a big-time receiver. Give me the demand the football receiver, and we obviously need someone that can make a play late in a game in that secondary.
That's great stuff right there, Beano. Unbelievable. Action-packed from start to finish. Phone call by you. I hope you have a Dwight Gooden great appearance today.
Love you guys.
Thank you. Love you. Hey, the Blue is leading the Gold right now, 17-0 in LSU's spring game. I'm pretty pumped.
I'm watching a little bit of this Georgia game, and the Dogs definitely got one in Jacob Eason.
He can throw it.
He's a nice-looking player.
He can throw
it. He's a nice-looking player.
There's no question about that. He can throw it. And they had a rapper de jour there today and pushed their crowd into the 90,000 range. Ohio State today, Cinco, 102,000 people. They set an all-time record. Anything you can do, they can do better. They make me want to vomit violently right on Cochise. I'm going to go back to our phones. I've got a special guest that will join me in studio coming up. You're going to be so proud and so thrilled to be a Tennessee fan after I share this story with you. It blows my mind. Because, you know, I'm used to dealing with the Twidiots. And that's the worst of humanity. I mean, no offense to the Twidiots. You know who you are. But y'all, how do I say this nicely? I want to say this with tact. Y'all are the worst of humanity. Let's go back to my phones. Terry's in Atlanta joining us now. Terry, you're in Atlanta. I welcome you in on your Smartway Garza Law Firm. Tennessee, fifth quarter fan reaction.
Hey, man.
Hey,
I
buddy.
I haven't called in a while.
Good to hear from you.
Guys, I think you guys hit on it exactly. I enjoyed the spring game. I watched it on TV. Beautiful day. you know, you saw some players that, you know, the kid who was hurt last year, Galvin, I mean, he looks outstanding. I like to see, the throws that were made to the tall, skinny kid and Ethan Wolf. But I'm going to go back to one other thing. Butch Jones is learning on the job. You know it. I know it. Anybody who watches it knows it. Toward the end of last year, sometimes they'd show him on the sidelines when the defense was on the field. He was going nuts on his headset. If you could read lips, he going all over Jancic. I mean, you know, the change, you know, it didn't surprise me the change was made. It showed more guts than I thought he had. But I think he has been all along learning on the job. I mean, he got up on Oklahoma. He tried to set on a lead. He changed his game plan and everything else. The same thing happened with Alabama. The same thing happened, you know, but I see him improving. Tony, you said it. Toward the end, after the Alabama game, and granted, we were playing teams that we were better than, but he let them play. He let them do the game that he had taught them how to play. And sometimes coaches just have to get out of the way.
I'll tell you this, I think I've seen enough in 3+ years of Butch Jones to be pretty confident in saying that the Butch Jones that's presented in public is a character. There's a disconnect when I think, cause I think I've been around that deal. I think I understand the way it goes on back. I think I understand recruiting. I think I understand how the sausage is made pretty much. And the persona that is portrayed by Butch Jones at press conferences on some of these nutty things, there's no way that person gets the recruits or gets the kind of effort he gets out of his players. So I truly believe that, and I've heard enough over there that Butch Jones in a team meeting room or with the kids, that's the real Butch Jones. I think he just, I think he just gives us what he thinks he needs to. And I think I'm pretty confident in that. Tony, would you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. Butch Jones, his first year on the job and his second year, told both of his teams, I know this for a fact, Terry. He said, don't you listen to a word I say in the media. What I say in here is what matters.
Correct.
The rest of it does not matter. Don't you pay attention. He said, I say stuff for the fans. I'm not talking to you. When I'm talking to you, I'm talking to you in here. That's when I'll talk to you.
I firmly believe that. I think sometimes it's a caricature that we see in the media, et cetera, and it has nothing to do with what actually happens in the team meeting rooms and between the lines. It couldn't possibly be that. Now, I will say, you guys have to agree with me, there's been some learning on the job here. I mean, he's never been in this position and the potential to have the cop it. You know, he's always followed Kelly, and now all of a sudden he's out on his own, and I think he's been doing some learning on the job. And granted, it's better than what we had before. It's, never mind. I don't even know why I said that. We all know that it was better than what we had before. But he, in a game situation against Alabama, they could have killed us, and he kept the game. I mean, we were in the game. I hate to say it. The goofy thing about 25 points, but in reality, if you look at it, on our schedule last year, we had two of the finals.
Well, you know, unfortunately, in our world, Butch Jones if he ever wins a championship, the next thing out of everybody's mouth is, yeah, but can he win two? If he wins two, it's, yeah, but can he win three? It's just the way it is. The guy, he comes from a small town. He hasn't had a whole bunch of success. You compare that to like, Lane Kiffin or someone else. He's always going to pale in comparison, regardless of what's on the paper. It's just the way it's going to be with this guy. And, I kind of like that.
I'm not a Kiffin guy, so I don't know if he'll pale.
No, but what I'm saying is, in the public mind, it's just like Kirby Smart. Kirby Smart's, he's never had to prove himself that I can tell.
No. He's on somebody else's coattail.
Right, and I took a kind of a cheap shot at Butch Jones earlier when I said he's always followed Brian Kelly, but you know what? That's exactly what it is. He followed Brian Kelly. He wasn't elevated like Phil Fulmer was. He followed him. He kind of had to work it out on his own and deal with it.
Buck Ballou, Dennis, down here the other day.
Uh-huh. What did he say?
He said on the radio that if they don't beat Tennessee, Georgia's no better than they were last year. And I thought, my God, a first-year coach, Buck? Why are you – he's got a hell of a platform down here. It's the number one show in Atlanta. And he said that, and I went, are you kidding me? And I said it to a couple of my friends who are, of course, everybody's a Georgia fan, but a couple of my friends who are Georgia fans, and they said, why didn't they throw him under the bus? I said, don't ask me.
Yeah,
don't beat Tennessee.
A little early for that.
Well, another guy, tell me what Muschamp's ever done.
Nothing.
Ever. I mean, he made his bones at LSU with Nick Saban. He goes to be the D coordinator under Nick Saban with the Dolphins. He comes back at Texas. They didn't do anything spectacular.
Media loves those guys. Media loves
what's
him.
What's he ever done?
They love him, and they love Kirby Smart.
Yeah.
Nothing.
That's the deal.
Everybody was thinking that if he didn't take the South Carolina job, Kirby was going to bring him over as his defensive coordinator.
Gotta love it.
I'm going, are you kidding me?
Hey, I really appreciate it.
He's an idiot.
Hey, thank you, man. I appreciate the phone call, Terry. Good hearing from you today. And my whole thing with this deal is, by the way, 865-200-5402. I just want to celebrate today. Celebrate another day of living, as Rare Earth once said, another day of life. There you go. As I'm live today in the Raymere studio today.
Hey, how about the way the field looked, Tony?
What'd you think of the field, Cinco?
I liked it. Well, a lot different than what we saw at the end of the year.
Yep. Now, I don't know how much they've done to it, to be completely frank. My intel is that Dave Hart has basically told the grounds crew not to bother doing too many things because there wasn't anything wrong with the field at the end of the year. Dave Hart decided.
Another stroke of genius.
He's a smart guy. And tonight's Hall of Fame is, let's see, why wasn't Peyton Manning at the spring game today? Could it be that he's gone into the inaugural class? They made an exception for him.
How about this one?
Here's
the greatest thing of all time.
Yes.
You played the game today in Neyland Stadium. Arguably, top three coach in the history of the Southeastern Conference, Steve Spurrier, came over to get the Neyland Award. And the guy's got a statue of himself at the 50-yard line right outside the stadium. And the guy's not even in your Hall of Fame. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
You're Donna Thomas, Lady Vol, Hall of Fame. Cinco, stay there. I got a special treat for you, for everybody listening, for all the ships at sea. This is the kind of stuff that makes what we do worthwhile. And I'm going to bring Ben Galloway in now, who you follow online. He calls himself Twisted T, Ben Galloway 6. Ben Galloway is made to ride over from, you guys live where?
About 25 minutes north of Clemson, South Carolina.
The Little Orange, home of the Leo Orange.
Exactly.
Now, I've always thought it'd be fun if we were to play, instead of these games, play a team like that in a spring game in like just a preseason format. That'd be fun, wouldn't it?
Be a blast.
And I'll tell you this, Virginia Tech, people don't know this yet, But they're having trouble selling their tickets for the Battle of Bristol. Virginia Tech is. They've had a very, shall we say, they're off to a slow start. And, Ben, I think if Tennessee would have played Clemson, they would have filled that place. If they had played West Virginia, they would have filled that place. There's any of a myriad of teams that they would have played. You know, Virginia Tech just doesn't have that big a fan base.
No, not that I can tell.
They don't?
I know a few back home, but not like other schools.
No, they don't. Share your story with us, and then what happened with you today.
Okay. Well.
And by the way, let me say this. I met you last fall at the Fish Pantry tailgate.
Yes.
You and your lovely wife.
Wendy.
And we had a great time talking, and you guys have a great spirit about you. And then I was like, wow. And I was hearing from you in the fall, and then I wasn't hearing from you there for a little bit. Share your story with us.
Okay. I'm 37 years old,
mm-hmm.
and I'm originally from Western North Carolina. I live, like I said, just north of Clemson now,
mm-hmm.
across the state line. I got married. I got two young boys.
Mm-hmm.
Riley will be turning 7 next week, and Weston's 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been having some issues. Went to the doctor. Had some tests, a few things done, and found out that I have colon cancer, stage 4 colon cancer that's metastasized to my liver. One thing led to another, seen a few doctors around our home hospitals back home, and realized my situation, I need a little bit more and a second opinion, and wound up going to the Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Atlanta, Georgia. And was accepted as a patient down there, and that's where I'm receiving treatment now. make a long story short, the biggest thing I've learned from this so far is humility, how to be humble, people helping. It's amazing what the small world we have with these phones and internet and Twitter and Facebook and, you know, small town communities in general.
Yep.
How many people actually do mean that they're praying for you, thinking about you, doing things for
yeah.
you. And that's no more evident than what happened today. We showed up early today. I brought both my sons. My oldest boy brought one of his school friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped by Dead End Barbecue.
See Jason Swain.
Seen Jason Swain and the guys up there. And, you know, just going to
do your thing.
Say hey,
yeah.
Have some lunch, and go to the spring game. Enjoy the day. Beautiful day, by the way. Nowhere I would rather be today than East Tennessee in Knoxville. Beautiful day.
You told me that earlier today on the phone, and boy, right on the money.
Hey, I'll tell you, you get news like I got, which, you know, kind of puts things in perspective. You don't take days like today for granted anymore. There's been times in the past that, you know, you enjoy a pretty day and you go on about your life, but nowadays, you make mental memories, mental pictures.
So share your... So could I see that poster while he's sharing his... you're pretty good at this. Wendy's on the spot here. I want you to see what the Tennessee family did for Ben today. They presented you with this. Now, what am I holding up here for the Periscopers?
That is the fellow, Mr. Spencer, that designed the checker kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
He got the photos off of my Twitter account and made up this little poster. And I understand they had some of the Vol family had a get together last night over in Knoxville, and a few of them today where I was at. And they had this poster made up, me and my family, is all the pictures of. And everybody, I mean, people that I've never met, don't even know, probably never even seen on Twitter, Facebook, or anything. I mean, prayers, we love you, beat this. It's so, makes you feel good. I mean, people that took their time to think of us when they could easily just, you know, pass the page and kept going and not give it a second thought. It's very, very touching.
You didn't know they were doing this?
Had no idea. Had no idea.
And there are all kinds of inscriptions written in here. There are people. Oh, man. Wow. There's Nathaniel Rutherford wrote you something. And God, look at that, man.
I'd say there's probably 20, 25 different people on there.
That
maybe
is
more.
That is phenomenal to know you're cared for.
That will be put up, framed up at my house to be kept forever.
Look at that. Wow.
What does it say at the bottom, Tom? One Tennessee, Vol family. I mean, proves it right there to me, you know?
Wow. Hmm. Man, we wish you well.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, it's just a bump in the road.
Tell me about your experience at the game today. You had your kids with you.
We had a blast. We the boys were excited. You know, they got the popcorn, their pretzels,
yeah.
You know, everything you remember growing up going to any sporting event, the food,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, the touch I liked was the Navy SEAL parachuters that came in to kick
Dude,
everything off.
That was amazing. They call those guys the leapfrogs.
Yes.
That's one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
The boys, that blew their mind. I mean, because you could see them however high they were coming down. It was beautiful.
Ben, it's she's got the video of it. Wow, I'm coming out of the sky. Appreciate you, man, just coming in and touching us here with your story.
I appreciate you letting me come by, and it's appreciate everybody thinking about me. And I'm, you know, I know there's people praying for us and our family, and we appreciate that.
Yeah, your family is so beautiful. How old are your kids?
Riley will be 7 next week, and Weston is 4.
And you left Greenville or the Clemson area what time this morning?
About 7:30.
Those kids are going to be climbing the walls later if they're not already.
I'm sure they are right now.
Are they with the grandparents?
They are. If there's any water left in the motel pool, who knows?
They are probably sitting there going, when are they coming back? Oh my gosh. Well y'all keep us updated on how you're doing.
We will.
And let us pray for you, man.
Appreciate what everybody's doing, especially the prayers. That's what's going to help me is the prayers.
Hmm.
And I've got a great support staff around me, my wife. I mean, I couldn't ask for anything better.
She's
anybody
awesome,
better.
She just made the she's crazy sign. Is she crazy?
No. Well, she's with me. Did I tell you anything?
That's a great line. That's probably what I would have said. Hey, I appreciate you stopping out and sharing
Thank
your story
you.
With
I appreciate
us.
It.
Thank you.
Appreciate you letting me come by.
Thank you. And Cinco, that's kind of I think a great way to wrap up our spring edition today here, having Ben come by and share his story with us, because that is wow, that's an amazing story. And for the Vol fans to touch this guy the way they have, I mean, I'm looking at him, I'm looking at his wife, and they were just absolutely blown away today by what was done for them. And I think that's incredible. I think we've had a celebratory day today, taking us into the summer of the spring and the summer of 2016, and it's going to be a time of great anticipation around here. Cinco, give me a final thought here on the festivities today.
Well, at 37, I can honestly say that's a young man there with you compared to me, and if there's a if I'm due any favors from the Lord above, I'm going to ask that they be deferred and send them his way, because I hope he's blessed with many more decades of cheering with the Vols and watching his sons grow up and living a healthy, long life. That puts it all in perspective. I think it was a great showcase of Tennessee football today and the Tennessee family, and that story just beats everything I saw on the field.
Woo! I really thank Ben for coming by today, and it was awesome stuff. Thanks for being there, brother.
As always, Tony, thanks for having me. Go Vols.
What a blessing. That's 90 minutes of us. I want to thank you. We'll be back with you from 11 to 1 on Monday, and I hope you have yourself a beautiful, wonderful, awesome, incredible rest of the weekend. Pray for Ben Galloway and his family, and we're going to get there. 2016 is going to be a very, 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 very special year here. We're greatly looking forward to it. I hope you have yourself a great rest of the weekend, and go Vols.
And then beyond that, then they have to pay their expenses, their meals, their lodging, that type of thing. Some of them end up owing money instead of making some money. And very few of them ever reach the point where they get in a televised bout where they actually make a little bit of money. I mean, even a Mike Tyson went through $250 million, and now he's out on the...
I was telling TJ English before we got started today, it is a real honor, a privilege, and a blessing to visit with him. His new book, Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger, and the World That Made Him. TJ English is our guest on Book Corner. TJ, thank you for joining. Great pleasure to visit with you.
Hey, it's my pleasure. It's always great to have a voice in the great state, Tennessee.
You are the author of also Patty Whacked and Havana Nocturne. The way you start this book out, there are so many ripples, so many lives this guy affected.
Yes, absolutely. Not just Bulger, but I would say the arrangement that was created in the criminal justice system in New England that gave Whitey Bulger his power, or at least facilitated his rise. That's a story that implicates a lot of people other than just Whitey Bulger. In fact, by the time I got around to writing this book, you know, there had been previous books about Bulger, biographies of Bulger, a book called Black Mass that was adapted into a film with Johnny Depp. I felt that the story was not so much about Whitey Bulger, or maybe there was nothing left to say about Whitey Bulger that hadn't already been said. But what hadn't really been addressed is Bulger's role as a confidential informant with the FBI and the criminal justice system, the Department of Justice based in Washington, D.C., how that facilitated his rise to power, and how he was kept out on the street to commit heinous crimes, is charged with 19 murders, and that his base of power was partly a consequence of a corrupt relationship with a corrupt system. And that was the part that needed to be detailed.
And you start out with an individual who is, he's lost his freedom, he's been framed, he's in jail. And that spoke to me right away. I thought I picked this book up to read about Whitey Bulger, but you make the case early on in the book. If that's what you picked this book up for, that's not what you're going to get. What you are going to get is, here are the lives that this guy, that's why I started out with just the ripple effect of everything that he did. I can't believe the role of our government in that. It's disgraceful.
Well, here's the moral of that story. When you get down in the mud with pigs, you wind up as a pig. And I think that what happened in New England, and this is not just New England, this is the way the criminal justice system operates in the United States of America. It's highly dependent on the use of informants. This exists at all levels of the system, the use of informants. And so agents, cops enter into relationships with criminals in the interest of gathering information, theoretically, to use against other criminals. So this is a largely unexamined facet. What's popular in movies and crime novels, but it goes largely unexamined within the criminal justice system itself. And so the Bulger story needed to be put in the proper historical context. And that context was that these corrupt relationships between agents and gangsters in New England that existed long before Whitey Bulger ever even came on the scene. In fact, Bulger inherited those relationships. And so I needed to go back in time to the mid-1960s and show how this framework of agents entering into dirty little relationships with criminals, and how that framework was set, and how Bulger plugged into that framework and then played it for all it was worth, utilized it, manipulated it, whatever you want to call it. But he didn't create it. He didn't invent it. That was in place before he came along.
You hooked me on page two, so congratulations.
We're talking about a guy named Joe Salvati.
Yes.
Joe Salvati was a guy who was framed for a murder he didn't commit. He was framed by a gangster informant witness named Joe Barbosa, notorious mob figure from New England in the 1960s. The FBI cultivated Barbosa the same way they would cultivate Bulger many years later. And they used him to make cases against the mafia, against the Italians. That's how you made your career in law enforcement. Mm-hmm. You made cases against the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And so Barbosa was the guy who was going to help them do that. And he was going to take the stand in various trials. And he took the stand in a murder trial and fingered four innocent men for a murder they didn't commit. And he did that with the compliance of his FBI handlers. And they knew what he was doing. And it was authorized all the way up the chain of command to J. Edgar Hoover. Now, we didn't know this at the time, of course, and it came out many, many decades later when the Whitey Bulger story exploded in public domain and the Pandora's box was opened and a lot of the dirty little details from going back half a century started to come out. And one of them was the framing of these innocent men. So I tracked down Joe Salvati, who was released after spending 30 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And I felt it was important to open the book with him for the reason you just mentioned, you know, the human consequences of the corruption that existed there for 45 years.
I put myself in his position. I'm sitting there thinking, TJ, and I told you before, you're so talented because you have the ability to take us there. And people who are blessed with the written word can do that. And kudos for that. And when I say you hooked me on page two, I'm sitting there as you're recounting this guy's story and how it goes all the way to Hoover, that they knew they were sending innocent men to jail. It was like shrapnel. Their lives truly didn't matter to these people. And then part of me says, what must it have been like for that man to be sitting in jail knowing I didn't do this? And how many more of him are out there that we don't know about because there's not a Whitey Bulger to tip us off? Did you have that thought at all as you were putting this book together?
Oh, yeah. I had many thoughts like that. I was haunted by the Joe Salvati story. I mean, not only was he framed knowingly by people within the criminal justice system, but in later years, whenever he tried to prove his innocence, whenever he tried to get his lawyers, tried to gather evidence, to present before parole boards to prove his innocence, he met nothing but resistance from the government, from the FBI, and from the Department of Justice. Because they knew that dirty little secret was buried deep within the system. And they were engaged in a cover-up to make sure that it would never be known. What was done would never be known. And this, by the way, to bring it back to Bulger, the reason this dirty little history was so important to me was it answers the question, why was Bulger so untouchable
mm-hmm.
when he was out on the street? And mm-hmm. part of that was Bulger forged a relationship as an informant with the FBI, knowing this history. He knew this history. Everyone in the criminal world knew these guys had been framed for a murder they didn't know. It was common knowledge. So Bulger knew that if he entered into a relationship with the FBI, he would become the custodian of this dirty history, and now he had entered into a pact with them where it was in all of their interest to keep this secret. And the fear was that if Bulger was ever busted or arrested, it would rip the scab off this wound, and all this dirty history would come to the surface, which, by the way, is exactly what did happen.
Bulger, it's really interesting because the narrative you would get if you didn't know. And I listen to a lot of talk radio out of Boston. I'm kind of a talk radio freak, and I listen to a guy named Dan Ray who's on at night on WBZ. And I know you talk about another longtime radio host up there. But Whitey Bulger is somebody that you hear people in that community talk about him, even to this day, has his defenders. He didn't put drugs on his own people. He kept it clean. He was kind of a good criminal, if there is such a thing. And the point you make in the book is, no, no, and no. He's a dark-hearted, dark criminal. Don't fool yourself. But he acted with impunity because he did all this with the blessing of our government. You make the point in the book that people died. and our government knew that he was still killing people, and they still did business with him.
I think the reason for that is that they feared that this dirty history would come out. Protecting Bulger became the same thing as protecting this dirty history from coming out. And that's what was behind it all those years. And Bulger was aware of that, and he played that. And we might also mention that his brother was arguably the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts, president of the Massachusetts State Senate for 16 years. His rise to power in the political world paralleled Whitey's rise to power in the criminal world. And so, you know, Bulger felt that he had it covered. And he did in a number of areas. You know, he had his brother in politics. He had the FBI in his pocket, so to speak. And that's why for 20 years as a mob boss in Boston, that guy never got so much as a parking ticket.
What's incredible to me, though, what I couldn't wrap my brain around was I would think in my simple mind, this is me now, okay? If I'm in law enforcement, and I'm cultivating a relationship with a bad guy, and he's an informant, wouldn't at some point I say to that person, hey, you know, when push comes to shove, while we're developing you, could you at least refrain from your criminal activity? Could you at least refrain from murder? Could you at least... But Bulger never saw himself as an informant. And that's a distinction that has to be made, right? He never saw himself. And they let him live in that little world, didn't they?
Yeah, I think his handler, John Connolly, who was from the same neighborhood of South Boston, kind of knew the Bulger brothers growing up, particularly the politician brother, Billy Bulger. Connolly was close to him and worked on Billy Bulger's political campaigns. He was Whitey's handler. And, you know, Whitey was the big white whale. Getting Whitey was a big feather in his cap.
Yeah.
And he cultivated a relationship with Whitey where Whitey was allowed to believe whatever he wanted to believe. I'm sure Whitey said something to the effect, I'm not a rat, you know, and if you ever say that I worked with you, I'll deny it, and I'll never take the stand. He laid down his terms for what he believed the arrangement was, and Connolly said, sure, absolutely, whatever you say. And then they proceeded to trade information, and it was mostly Whitey giving Connolly information, and then Connolly, of course, was also giving Whitey information that, by the way, led directly to murders.
Murders!
Led directly to murders, and in fact, murders of people who were also cooperating witnesses that were going to be used to make a case against Whitey. Those were some of the people Whitey was murdering. So it was a sweet arrangement for Bulger. What makes the Bulger story so extraordinary is that he had manipulated himself into this unprecedented kind of series of relationships that allowed him to stay out there. But again, as I try to detail in this book, he could not have done it without a corrupt system that had been in place for a long time.
We visit with T.J. English, where the bodies were buried, Whitey Bulger and the world that made him. And this is a you-will-not-be-able-to-put-it-down book. I mean, the more you read, the more you get into this thing, and the characters come to life, and in some cases, they go under their deaths. Let's go back. We're back in that period where the FBI is protecting Whitey Bulger, and you're talking about this issue with him and how he's just doing business as he does it. But there are people inside the FBI during this time, particularly one guy from Houston, and I can't recall his name off the top of my head, but he's transferred into Boston. He's an outsider. He's unfamiliar with the arrangement, but he knows right away when he's around Whitey Bulger, there is something wrong with this deal, and he wants to shut him down as an informant. He wants to shut him down, which means in the FBI world, that's it, we're done with you. But there's no way that was going to happen. If you can, unpack some of that for me.
Yeah, that's a good point. There were people within the system who smelled a bad stink in the Bulger arrangement, and they were usually outsiders who would be assigned to the Boston division of the FBI, and they'd come in and they'd quickly get a sense that this Bulger guy was untouchable. If anyone tried to open a case against him or any agent was getting information from an informant about Bulger and they'd bring it into the office, all of a sudden their files would disappear or their case would get shut down. They were meeting a weird and eerie kind of resistance from within the system that they couldn't put their finger on. They couldn't identify. I always compare it to that movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, the people around you have been taken over by the alien force, but you can't tell by looking at them because they look and act just like anyone else. And when you get into trouble, you turn to them thinking they're going to help you, and it turns out they're in on the conspiracy. And that was the case because there were some very high-placed people within the system that were benefiting greatly from having Bulger as an informant. There were the FBI agents, and there was also a very aggressive U.S. attorney in that area named Jeremiah O'Sullivan. He was kind of the New England version of Rudy Giuliani. He was making big cases against the mafia, and his rising career was based on that. And so these people protected Bulger. And if anyone within the system tried to take Bulger down or go after Bulger, their investigations were sabotaged. They were sabotaged from within. What happened over time is everyone up there just became defeated by it. It was sort of a dirty little secret in the entire jurisdiction of New England that Bulger had some kind of arrangement with the FBI, and because of that, he was untouchable. And this was particularly disheartening because bodies were dropping. People were getting murdered. And then they started getting murdered even outside of Boston area. Murder in Miami, a murder in Tulsa, Oklahoma, all of it related to the Bulger organization. So this thing was metastasizing and becoming bigger than anyone could control.
Meanwhile, our federal government, the FBI, knows in some cases that hits are coming. They basically watch this stuff go down. And you talk in the book about how there were a couple of women who died and just met cruel deaths at the hands of this madman. And speaking of Whitey Bulger, he knew he was going to get away with it. And basically he killed these women, you say in the book. Why? Because he could. There really wasn't any reason to kill these women other than they'd become a nuisance. But that's what it became for him. I mean, it was almost like he was God.
Yeah, he and his partner, Steve Fleming, who was also a homicidal maniac and also an FBI informant and had been even before Bulger was. In fact, I think Fleming is one of the ones that encouraged Bulger to become an informant because he knew what a benefit it could be. These guys were killing people left and right over a period of a couple decades, and they were getting away with it. And I think what happened is they developed delusions of grandeur. They started committing murders that really didn't have anything to do with business. The murders of these two young women, one of them was an ex-girlfriend of Fleming's, and the other was Fleming's stepdaughter, who he was having a sexual relationship with, and they feared that she was going to talk about that. So they lured her to a house, and Bulger strangled her to death with his bare hand. The level of violence is horrifying, but yeah, I think these guys came to believe they were God, that they could kill whoever they wanted to kill and get away with it. And the reason they believed that was because they had for 20 years.
In looking at your book, it's way worse than that trial was depicted. Do you agree with that after digging into it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was probably the main reason I wrote the book. You know, when Bulger went on the run, he in 95, he got tipped off that his FBI guy had now retired, and he was no longer an informant, so he was somewhat unprotected. And the DEA was about to indict him and arrest him, and his old FBI handler got word of that and tipped him off. Bulger went on the run. We didn't see him again for 16 years. He was discovered out in Santa Monica, California, with his girlfriend. And he was brought back to Boston and put on trial. My agent approached me around that time because I've written a couple previous books about different aspects of the Irish-American mob in the United States, a book called The Westies and also Paddywhacked, which, by the way, when they did arrest Bulger in Santa Monica, that book was on his bookshelf right next to his bed. So he was a guy, and he's mentioned in that book, mm-hmm. Bulger's a guy who was well aware of his image and sort of cultivating his image. Anyway, they brought him back, and my agent suggested that I write a book on it, and I said no. There had been many books written about Bulger, and I just didn't think there was anything left to say. But I was going to cover the trial as a journalist and do a series of reports for the Daily Beast website. And as the trial began to take shape, it became clear to me that a kind of a cover-up or a whitewash was taking place, that the government had a problem. At prosecuting Whitey Bulger for his crimes was the easy, because he'd been on the run for so long, a lot of evidence had been amassed, and a lot of his former associates made deals with the government and become witnesses and would be testifying against him. So prosecuting him for his crimes, 19 murders, all the other crimes, racketeering, was the easy part. The hard part was for the government to keep the Bulger narrative from spilling over, yep, into areas that would be embarrassing to them.
Yep.
And that had to do with his relationship with the system and who had protected him. And in fact, that he had been protected by Jeremiah O'Sullivan, who became the U.S. attorney, the exact same office that was now prosecuting Bulger, had a corrupt relationship with Bulger. And so I began to see the trial as a very carefully orchestrated cover-up of the larger context of the Bulger story. And that's really when I felt that there was a book that not only could be written, but needed to be written.
And the more you dug, I can imagine, it was probably like the gift that kept on giving. I mean, at some point you had to say to yourself, there's no way in hell all this is true.
Yeah, it was shocking. It's still shocking to me. I mean, we were talking about Joe Salvati being framed and that it was authorized all the way up to Hoover. When I tell that story to people, they look at me like I'm making it up.
No, nobody wants to believe that. Right. Nobody wants to believe that.
Yeah, they look at it like it's some, you know, Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm, conspiracy story,
right,
or something.
Mm-hmm.
But this was adjudicated. These guys sued the government after they did finally get released 30 years later, and they, mm-hmm, got a settlement of something like $103 million,
mm-hmm,
between the families of the four of them. This was all proven and laid out. And the memos, although the government fought it tooth and nail,
mm-hmm,
the judge and the court were able to get the memos that showed J. Edgar Hoover signing off on this arrangement. So the way I see it, the cautionary tale here is when the philosophy of ends justifies the means becomes the driving force in our criminal justice system, then you get these grave injustices. You get these grave injustices, by the way, that are committed by the so-called good guys, by the people within the,
yeah,
system, because they feel a self-justification in what they're doing, and they use their role as agents or cops or whatever as a kind of self-justification for taking the law into their own hands.
Yeah, because the end's going to justify the means.
Yes.
And then at what point, well, you know, there's a couple innocent people went to jail, and I got this one. Here's a guy giving a hood a ride home, and, well, he gets whacked and he gets murdered, but we got to protect this guy. And that literally happened to an innocent guy who gave somebody a ride home, and Whitey just decided it wasn't time for him to live any longer. Those types of things. I'm reading this book and I'm going, when does it end? But the truth is, it just didn't end. There's no telling how many people really died, I guess is my point.
Not only that, you can take the Bulger story,
yes,
the arrangements, the
yes,
use of informants, and how Bulger manipulated his way into,
yes,
that position of power, and you can pretty much assume that's taking place all over the United States.
Yes.
It's taking place in the narco war in Mexico.
Yes.
You know, as U.S. agents attempt to bring that down, it's, mm-hmm, taking place amongst, you know, meth-dealing organizations in the Midwest. It's taking place in a lot of places, and it's allowed to take place, mm-hmm, because the public in general doesn't want to know how the sausage is made. That's a phrase that was given to me by John Connolly, who's now in prison, the only guy, the only agent, the only representative of the system who ever did time for this whole arrangement with Bulger. I kind of think of him as a bit of a fall guy. although he did a lot of bad things, and he should have done sometime. He basically was the guy who was set up to take the fall for the whole arrangement. I interviewed him. I spoke to him by phone when he's in prison in Florida, and I asked him about the way things are done, and he said, well, you know, people don't want to know how the sausage is made. They choose to look the other way. We want our agents to take down terrorists. We want them to take down criminals, and we don't want to know how they do it until, of course, it explodes and it's a huge embarrassment and there's corruption and all of that. Then we wash our hands of it. But up until that point, as a public, we choose not to know.
Let me ask you this, as somebody that's really dug into that deal, and we visit with T.J. English, Where the Bodies Were Buried is the name of the book, and it is about Whitey Bulger and the world that made him. And literally the world that made him, as we're talking about here, is the FBI, also those that were in power, those that are entrusted and in charge to protect us, who sent innocents to jail. Innocent people were killed in the midst of this guy's reign of terror up in the Boston area. And TJ just asked a great question, which is, how much of this goes on to this moment? How much of this is going on right now? And furthermore, let me ask you about, let's go back to the FBI in that area, or just the people that were involved outside of the gentleman that's in prison right now. If there's justice, how deep would that have gone? How deep would the pool, do you feel like, of people they could have gotten or should have gotten?
Well, it would have gone beyond the FBI, because it would have gone to the for those who don't know, the Department of Justice is the governmental body that oversees, you know, FBI, DEA,
right,
all the law enforcement agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, decisions are kicked up the hierarchy, and they're made by the Department of Justice. And in the Bulger case, there was one period in the 80s where there had been something like four murders related to the Bulger organization within a period of about 18 months.
Mm.
And other law enforcement organizations were sniffing around it and were crying foul, and it had begun to appear that there was a problem here. And there was a major summit meeting in Washington, D.C., of Department of Justice officials, Boston officials, and so forth. And they should have been concerned that they had informants out on the street that were killing people. But what they were concerned about in that meeting, and I've seen the memos of it and I write about it in the book, what they were concerned about was protecting their assets. Bulger and Flemmy were seen as valuable assets,
mm-hmm,
who were delivering cases for them. And their main goal when this started to become a crisis was to manage the crisis and to protect their assets. There are a number of stages along the way in the Bulger story where they should have known, could have known, might have known what was going on. And in every case, they chose to stick their head in the sand. And so I think what there should have been at some point were professional hearings on a national level that laid all of this out, called into account people who were in decision-making positions of power in the hierarchy when this was going on. But that rarely happened. You know, as we see in other areas of government, that rarely happened. The system, the final line of the book is, the system protects itself. And that's largely what happened in this case. So people were allowed to sort of slink off into retirement. Many of them engage in crimes where there was a statute of limitations and you couldn't get to them. And there's a lot of people who were culpable in the Bulger scandal.
I like the point you make. Not only do they slip off into retirement, they slip off into retirement with full pensions and full benefits. Meanwhile, there's a trail of wasted lives. There's a trail of death. There's a trail of loved ones that are trying to carry on from some of these things that have been perpetrated upon them by a government that is supposed to be protecting them. I mean, there is something wrong with that picture.
Oh, yeah. It's scandalous, and it's disheartening, and it's depressing. And to me, the most depressing thing about it is the system's inability to be honest with itself about what was happening and to engage in corrective actions. It seems to be that the modus operandi of the system is to protect itself. And I think people operating within the system know that. It's understood you're supposed to fall on your sword in certain situations and take one for the team and all of that. Protecting the system becomes something that's larger than any one individual. Occasionally we have whistleblowers, people who go against the grain. And in the story of Bulger, there was one character, a guy named Bob Fitzpatrick, yep, an FBI agent, who went to Boston and tried to kick up some dust.
Mm-hmm.
And he was destroyed by the system. I described him taking the stand at the trial and trying to get into some of this corruption. And he was destroyed by the prosecution, by the U.S. Attorney's Office, simply because he was painting a picture of corruption that they were unwilling to accept.
Yeah, so on one hand, they're prosecuting Whitey Bulger. What I like about the end of the book is, and you talk about the defense, and this defense has been used before, and their defense was, I mean, they allowed him. Look how corrupt your government is that's trying to prosecute him. Look at it. A lot of the stuff they deemed inadmissible, and they even tried to kill their own in Fitzpatrick, as you were talking about. And that's the levels to which these people will go, even years later, to cover up what went on.
Yeah, what the defense was going for was a process called jury nullification, where you go before the jury, you admit, in the opening statement, the defense lawyers admitted Bulger was a racketeer, that he engaged in illegal gambling, and they even admitted narcotics, which is something Bulger had never admitted before. They didn't admit to any of the murders, but they said he was a professional criminal and had been for a long period of time, and he was very good at it, made a lot of money. And the reason he was so good at it was that he had the system on his side. He paid off people at every level of law enforcement, from local cops all the way up to federal agents. And the theory was that if you were to find my client guilty, you have to find the entire system of justice guilty, because they enabled him in his criminal acts. And so that's kind of what they were going for, I guess, some version of that, although they never came right out and stated it as jury nullification, mm-hmm, because that's technically not allowed as a process.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a couple problems. Number one, the judge didn't really allow them to make that case in court. She denied or hindered their ability to make that case. And the other problem was Bulger was refusing to admit that he had ever been an informant for the FBI. It seemed that in the criminal underworld, believe it or not, there are codes. Mm-hmm. And the number one code is that you don't rat. You don't become a rat. And so Bulger, here he was on his last legs trying to shape his public image, denying that he ever had been an informant when quite clearly he had been an informant. But he was unable to look himself in the mirror and admit that to himself, I guess.
You know who I identified with at the end, and I get from your writing that you kind of did too, was juror number 12, whose name I can't pronounce. I can pronounce her first name, Janet.
Janet Ular.
She's not a sheep. She didn't just go along.
Well, she was shocked. It was sort of a relief to be able to pull back and see the trial and the story through her eyes,
mm-hmm,
because so many others were compromised in one way or another. She was a true innocent, somebody who knew very little about the Bulger story or the criminal underworld and how it operates or any of that. And she just was stunned by the case itself. She was particularly shocked by the use of other criminals to testify against Bulger, people who were as bad or worse than Bulger, who got sweet deals and were out on the street. I mean, there was one witness, a guy named John Martirano, who was a member of Bulger's gang. He admitted to 20 murders. He served something like 7.5 years and was out on the street back in Boston. In fact, I met the guy, had dinner with him one night. Luckily, I didn't know the full extent of his resume at the time. He later published a book called Hitman, which he detailed all his murders. When I met him, I didn't know about that, and it's probably a good thing that I didn't, although I knew he was a gangster and a killer. These people were out on the street testifying against Bulger, and she was shocked by that, and she was shocked by, particularly when the trial ended, you know, every time the name Jeremiah O'Sullivan came up, the former Strike Force chief and later U.S. attorney, the prosecution objected, and the judge backed up the objection, and it was clear that O'Sullivan and what he represented in the Bulger story was being kept out of that trial. So she was getting a sense that there was some kind of a cover-up going on during the trial. And it was hard for someone like her because she knew Bolger was guilty, and she voted guilty, and she knew he was guilty of a lot of the crimes. He'd admitted, his lawyers admitted to a lot of the crimes. But she had a sense of this larger context that was taking place, and that was very frustrating to her.
Yeah, and she became... almost behind the scenes, you got the sense that she became almost a nuisance because she saw through what was really going on there. And good for her for being perceptive
enough.
Sure,
Bob Fitzpatrick, the FBI agent, Janet Ullman.